From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. For 40 days, women in Iran have been taking to the streets in protest, chanting women, life, freedom. This started in mid-September when Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian Kurdish woman, paid a visit to her brother in Tehran. She was taken by the country's morality police for an alleged dress code violation and died in their custody. Since then, the country has seen massive protests. The primarily young women and girls leading the charge are calling for bodily autonomy, economic justice, and an end to the authoritarian regime headed by 83-year-old Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who has ruled Iran since 1989. The world is watching what's happening in Iran, and that includes many members of the Iranian diaspora here in Illinois. Joining us this morning to talk about what's happening and what it means is Dr. Faranak Miraftab. She grew up in Iran and attended university in the capital city of Tehran, but the government crackdown following the revolution of 1979 forced her to seek political asylum in Norway. That was in 1982, and it came shortly after her sister, Farshad, was imprisoned and killed without trial in Tehran's notorious Evin prison, along with at least 50 other young women and girls. Dr. Miraftab today is a professor of regional and urban planning at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Dr. Miraftab, thank you for making the time to join us today on the 21st Show, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Also with us is Hoda Katebi, an Iranian-American activist and writer based in Chicago. She graduated from the University of Chicago in 2016 and will graduate from the UC Berkeley Law School in 2023. She's been collaborating with and advising activists based in Tehran. Hoda, welcome to the 21st Show to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, as ever, if you want to join our conversation, the number to do so is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show, at 21st Show. So, Hoda, I want to begin with you. I mentioned the mid-September death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian Kurdish woman. It seems to have sparked these demonstrations. Can you tell us a little bit about who she was and what happened?
Absolutely. So, Mahsa or Jina Amini, as you mentioned, 22 years old. She's a Kurdish woman who was visiting Tehran for the first time with her family. And she was stopped and arrested by the Gasht-e-Irshad, or the morality police of Iran, which is a force that is designed to enforce, among other things, the Iranian government's mandatory dress codes. And as she was arrested and taken in a van, soon after she suffered severe brain injuries and passed away in a coma. And so I think what's also really important to note about this moment is that this is not the first time something like this has happened. This is not the first time, women have been beaten or arrested by the Gasht-e-Irshad. This is not the first time that people have been killed in the custody of the Iranian government. And this moment was actually coming after an escalation of policing of women's bodies in public spaces. Just a few weeks prior to this, the Iranian government announced it would start using facial recognition technology to be able to identify women using or breaking the dress code. And before that, the Raisi regime also announced new fines for dress code violations. So we're seeing this as sort of like an escalation of policing of women's bodies in public spaces. And I think Iranians are just fed up. And I think this is coming in a lot of sort of political escalations as well, too, that led to this major moment.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. And I want to come back to some of these currents that were leading up to this moment that we're in now. But just to stick with where we are at the present day, Dr. Miraftab, can you talk a little bit about the government's response to the protests that have arisen in the wake of this death in the custody of the morality police?
Sure. There has been massive crackdown and oppression and killing. I have followed the human rights activist news agency that updates the estimated numbers of killings and arrests, and I can maybe share that with you as of latest. I have the there are, you know, the oppression machine is not really just limiting itself to the street protests, but they are going into schools of high schoolers, equivalent of middle schoolers here, and they crack down on these children. So there has been, the most recent was in a school in Erbil, one of the ethnic Turkish regions of Iran, that they beat up their school kids so badly that one of them passed away on the way to the hospital. So I want the audience to understand that we are dealing with a system that is acts of ruthless and has no shame, as the chanting of people goes, Bisharaf, which means, you know, having no ethic, no shame. They are actually killing children. They are killing young people and live ammunition in the streets. And still people are not staying behind. So the human rights activist news agency I mentioned releases that there has been 252 killed. 36 of them have been children under the age of 18. Estimated arrests are 13,523. There are massive arrests happening all over the country. And those who have been arrested that have been identified are about 1,000. There has been 119 cities across the country participating in these protests and 101 universities participating again in the strikes, etc. Workers are joining the protests. So we have Aslaviye, Boucher, Kangan. These are oil workers and petrochemical plants that workers have gone on strike. And of course, university students have been going on strike, and teachers have been joining. So this is really a movement that is spreading across all ethnic groups, all regions, and facing brutality of the system, where they have been stealing bodies of people they killed. Like, for example, body of Niku Shakarani was stolen so that her parents could not, this is a 16-year-old, her parents could not have a burial for her, the way Mahsa Amini's burial turned into a protest. And, you know, so they have been threatening families of young people they killed so that they would stay silent, they would not speak to media and others. And also we see on footages that come, there are people in private clothing, and with carrying, guns and shooting live ammunition. So the way in which the regime has been trying to stop this movement is just endless. But it hasn't been able to stop it because people are fed up.
Hoda, what extent have you been in communication with people in Iran, and what are you hearing from them?
Well, I am. Oh, sorry.
Hoda, you take that first, and then I want to come back to Dr. Maraftab on that.
Sure. I'm in conversation to the extent that the censorship of the internet and connection is strong enough to be able to maintain those conversations. A lot of the people who I've been in touch with are on the ground and organizing and protesting. And I think something that I've seen that has given me at least a lot of hope from these conversations have been that the people of Iran have been a lot more unified on the ground. So for example, the fact that Mahsa or Gina Amini was Kurdish, the Iranian government, as many governments do, spend just so much time, energy, and resources into divide and conquer strategies to make it seem that ethnic minorities are separate. They're always trying to separate. They always have very violent motivations. All these sorts of very horrific language that's used to kind of divide and conquer Iranian society in order to continuously dominate and maintain power. And yet this moment has also allowed for a rupture in a lot of this ideology and has undone decades of this sort of propaganda that the government has spread and has brought ethnic minorities hand in hand together in the streets fighting for the same things, which is woman, life, freedom, which is the main slogan that's being used that, as you mentioned in the intro, that it talks about women's justice and liberation, but also connects that to the economy, connects that to a holistic understanding of what liberation and freedom could look like for all people in Iran right now.
Dr. Marefta, what are you hearing from people in the country, if you are in communication with anyone there?
Yeah, so mostly through my students who are recently moved to U.S. for their studies, and also social media that I can follow whatever gets out here. And this is, as Hoda was mentioning, it's incredible that the unity that we see in this movement, that, and despite this, the dominant system, the regime has tried to scare people that, oh, this will lead into disintegration of country, different ethnic groups, independence, and, you know, basically civil war, et cetera. And there has been a heightened consciousness about this, and incredible unity in the slogans, people chanting that from Kurdistan to Balochistan, we are together, and what comes across is that the unity against this regime is across the board, men and women, different ethnic groups, rural and urban areas and various cities, and as well as various classes. This is no longer something that is limited to a student movement or a middle class or only women's issues. As we talked, you know, it's also the problems with unemployment and corruption and injustice in across the board, politically, economically, socially.
Hoda, I've been seeing that there have also been protests among members of the Iranian diaspora in other places in the world, including in some American cities. Can you talk about what you've been seeing here in response to what's happening back in Iran?
Absolutely. So we've seen massive outpour of solidarity among the Iranian diaspora, as well as allies and everybody coming out to support. There's been, you know, protests around the world, multiple days of action. And there has been just so much effort. I think that this moment has really captured a lot of us in diaspora, many of us who cannot return to Iran for political reasons, like myself. I think we also are kind of searching for how we can channel our own rage, trauma, and hope and excitement and optimism. And I think that's what movements always look like, is, you know, protests. As someone who's participated in protests and riots here in the United States, I know that things look messy, things are scary, but there's also so much opportunity for hope. I think what's heartbreaking that I've been seeing, at least, is that while Iranians on the streets have avenues to actually tangibly enact change and reduce violence with their own hands by, for example, like lighting a police car on fire, right? Like, that's one less oppressive vehicle to be able to use against Iranian people. And those are productive ways of creating change. Here in the United States, we, unfortunately, in Iranian diaspora does not have the same access to be able to enact that level of change. And so what we have been seeing actually in the diaspora has been almost a sort of internal witch hunt that has been happening within the diaspora that has been replicating actually a lot of sort of dictator style tactics of silencing that have just actually unfortunately pushed a lot of the diaspora to the far right in terms of policy proposals, and really silencing any progressive Iranian voices that have been against that. So I think what we're seeing in Iran, the streets of Iran, is very optimistic and exciting and hopeful. And I think while there's a lot of energy in the diaspora, sometimes it's not always being directed in the most positive ways that replicates what's happening on the streets of Iran.
Interesting. We need to take a break in about a minute and a half here, so we don't have much time. But one potent visual image out of the protests there has been women removing and even burning their headscarves in the street. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that in the context of that and the mandatory dress code for women in Iran.
Yeah, absolutely. So over the radio, you can't see this, but I do wear the hijab. I'm Muslim. I've been wearing the hijab for about 17 years. And I think what's really important to recognize is a specific context of Iran, in which a mandatory headscarf, and being able to like burn a symbol of the state or destroy a symbol of the state is not an assault on Islam. As someone who does choose to wear the hijab, and is Muslim very proudly, I think recognizing that any state that's willing to co-opt symbols in order to maintain power and maintain dominance, being able to act against those symbols is a very powerful message and a very powerful motive. So I think, for example, images of burning mandatory headscarves in Iran is very powerful, is a really strong image that is very much in response to state decisions to decide to use this mandatory hijab as a symbol of itself. Of course, I think burning a headscarf in any other context outside of Iran, for example, like in Europe, in many countries where they're trying to ban the hijab, such as France, I think has a very different context and a very different message that does reek of Islamophobia. But in Iran, I think these images are very powerful, and say a lot as to how the symbols are used by the state and how people are able to enact resistance by targeting those symbols.
All right, we're going to come back and continue this conversation after a short break. We're talking about the protests that have been happening in Iran for 40 days now. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about the views from Illinois of what has been happening in Iran. Massive street protests for 40 days now since a 22-year-old woman named Asha Amini, who was visiting with her family the city of Tehran for the first time. She was arrested by the country's morality police and then died in their custody. Since then, massive protests led primarily by young women and girls. There has been solidarity, as we've been hearing, across the Iranian diaspora, including from people in America and in Illinois. We're talking about that with Hoda Katebi, who is an Iranian-American activist and writer based in Chicago, also a law student, and Dr. Farhanak Miraftab, who is a professor of regional and urban planning at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And Dr. Miraftab, I wonder if you could put what we're seeing now in the context of other protest movements that have erupted in Iran, right? 1999, 2009. Does this feel different to you as somebody who's been observing those from afar?
Sure, thank you. What we see today, actually, I'm glad you mentioned it. It's something that we see each eruption of protest in Iran getting more and more closer to each other. So we had 1988, you know, massive killings in Evin prison. Then we have 1999, which was protests and oppression of crackdown on university students. Then it comes to 2009, which was a fraud, electoral fraud, and the large-scale protests that happened in the country. And then we see that the intervals of these protests gets each time closer to each other. 2017, there was, we call it Dukhtarane Enqilab or Revolution Girls, that they started taking their scarves and put it at stick in public spaces. Then we have 2 years later, 2019, was big massive protests for gas prices being hiked. And then again, 2 years later was the, and in 2021 was the water mismanagement that brought rural peasants also into protests and collective gatherings. And then now we have the 2022. So you see that the intervals of these protests getting closer. But what is different, I think, from between this and perhaps 2009, which was the massive protests against the electoral fraud, or even 19, late 1970s, the revolution, so-called revolution, that I was part of in back then in the movements that brought the Islamic Republic into the power. A major difference is the way in which this organizing is happening. These are not large-scale, massive show of power in the streets. Actually, because of the crackdown that this regime has had, it is very much in the style of pop-ups in neighborhoods, wherever people are. It is leaderless and horizontal. Some would see it as a source of worry, and I myself see it as actually a positive feature of these movements and current protests, that they are leaderless. Actually, there was a video recording of a young girl on social media addressed to the other school kids saying, if you see that in your protest somebody is standing out, make sure you don't allow that, because then that person becomes target of oppression. Make sure that you all speak, you know, as loud as the other person, and don't allow anyone to stand out and become a leader, become a target. I think that kind of horizontal organizing and neighborhood-based organizing that is happening is something that for the in the feminist kind of politics, we call it informal politics of mostly among women, this has been common, and feminists have been advocating for horizontal organizing. But I think it is also outcome of oppression of the regime. They arrested and killed and destroyed every possible political organization and opposition. So now even if they want to negotiate with anyone to corrupt the movement, they don't have any. There is nothing left for them to go and try to corrupt or negotiate with. And that has become a strength of the movement. So that is another major difference that I see in what is happening today than 1979 movement or even 2009 massive protests that we observed. So I think what we also mentioned, that the unity that we see in this one is definitely something that stands out. It is across classes, across ethnic groups, and also women and men. You know, sorry, I'll take longer to respond to this, but going back to the 1979, I was a left and part of the left movement against monarchy, against Shah, and later in the after transition against the Islamic Republic, both of who have been authoritarian regimes. But always issues of gender was silenced, and we were told if you bring up women's issues, you are basically dividing. It's a subsidiary issue. It's a secondary issue. But today, after 40 years of oppression of this regime and what we call it gender apartheid, we see that men have joined women in putting women's and gender equality as the central to their demand. And this is something again that is different and very hopeful, that young men or along young women asking for an understanding that men's liberation is also through women's liberation and equity. So these are just some of the things that I thought stand out for me and why I am hopeful about this movement and its ability to bring about, its ability to be perhaps the beginning of the end.
That's a really interesting way you put that, that women's issues are really human issues, and it's spreading across the spectrum. I wonder, there's something else you talked about, Dr. Maraftab, that was this idea of lateral politics or horizontal politics. And it reminds me, you know, without a leader, without a central node, it sounds like you're talking about the internet. And Hoda, Kitebi, that brings up this question of technology. Do you see technology aiding organizing and resistance efforts in recent weeks and months?
I would say yes and no. I think that social media, without a doubt, has absolutely brought this struggle and demands to the forefront of just global conversation in a way that obviously without the internet, it just wouldn't be there. And you know, reporters and journalists wouldn't have the same type of pressure to focus on and like uplift these stories without everyone talking about this and flooding social media so much and getting hashtags trending regularly. That being said, I also don't want to overemphasize the role people outside of Iran have when I think oftentimes it could create some sort of like saviorism dynamics or that like people need to be Iranians' voices, whereas Iranians on the ground are more than capable of being able to hold their government accountable on their terms. And so I think that there's sort of two parts to this of like I think there's a necessity of global people solidarity. But I think once that crosses the line of like that delves into a bit of like white saviorist language, I think Iranians globally are pushed back against that in terms of like a necessity or a need to have sort of celebrities in the United States uplift what's happening in Iran. That being said, I do think that there is a lot to be said about the fact that the Iranian government does also have a historic practice of cutting off the internet or reducing internet or weakening the internet and censoring apps and social media apps in moments like this to make sure that Iranian voices on the ground are not spread and uplifted. So I think there's a lot to be said about the role of being able to listen to Iranian voices on the ground, uplifting voices on the ground in Iran, and being able to share like those voices and those images and videos. And I think it's really important because what we saw in November 2019, for example, which was wide-scale economic protests, mostly by workers and working class communities. And because there was very little international solidarity with worker struggles, both actually within Iran, unfortunately, as well as outside of it, it was very easy for the Iranian government to just shut off the internet. I think human rights organizations report that over 1,500 people were killed in the streets and then, return like nothing happened. And so I think right now we are seeing a very stark difference from that in a moment where I think the Iranian government also has seeing pressure of not being able to actually shut off the internet in the same way just because of how powerful Iranians on the ground are right now, both in terms of organizing effectively against the government on the ground, as well as organizing their language, their message, these photos that are coming outside of Iran as well too. And I think being able to really centralize this demand of woman life freedom and the way that that also just has such universal applicability, I think has also allowed a level of solidarity that is genuine among people around the world that is important, that I think it also does play a role in this moment.
Well, not to take anything away from the people who are on the ground in Iran, I do want to ask a question about the American government policy here. And there was recently an essay in the New York Times by Karim Sajapour, who's with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He wrote, U.S. policy toward Iran has for years faced a paradox that has been poorly understood. The coercive policies needed to counter the Islamic Republic's nuclear and regional ambitions, for example, sanctions, may inadvertently serve to strengthen, not weaken, the regime's grip on power. I think his key point there is that global isolation is more often beneficial to authoritarian regimes than global integration. And Dr. Maraftab, I guess I want to ask you, do you think U.S. policy has done more to help or hurt the cause of freedom for the people of Iran?
I think we should go a little bit back, and I want to take the liberty of talking about how strengthening of Islamic fundamentalism in the region has been something that has been in the interest of U.S. and the West. So I think to start from now, we are starting from second chapter of the book. So I would like to go back a little bit and think about 43 years ago, when the West, the US, UK, France, and Germany met in Guadeloupe. The Guadeloupe meeting precisely they decided that Shah was not savable, and they lend their support to the Islamic fundamentalism or Islamic regime in Iran, calling it the wanting to create an Islamic belt around Russia to avoid a growing influence of Russia, which was going, you know, in Afghanistan, etc. So if you go back to when the 1979, Iraq, Turkey, Afghanistan, these were none of these kind of Islamic fundamentalism was not in political power in the region. So I think having the West, and including U.S., thought having Islamic state or Islamist states in the region would serve them as a way of avoiding the Russian influence in the Cold War era. So that is something that started as thinking that this would serve their interests. And now, of course, you see that the whole region and its this instability, you could say, in some way is serving and in some ways not. So when it comes to sanctions, I think targeted sanctions against those agents of the regime, the Revolutionary Guard and key actors of the regime, is something that I would support and think that could help. But the overall sanction, as we know, has put a lot of pressure on people, on you know, and not the ones on the top who can still do their wheeling and dealing. So that I don't support that.
But Katebi, I wonder what, if there's anything you would like to see from the U.S. government as it's responding to what's happening over there, or is hands off maybe the best approach for now?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that I think we can look at this history of sanctions and sanctions regimes on Iraq, for example, as an example of just how destructive that they are. And they both lead and embolden authoritarianism in countries as they, you know, march toward isolationism. And that allows, for example, moments like this one where, you know, if you are sanctioning the Iranian government, and so Iranians only are able to have telecommunications and comms related through the Iranian, or like controlled by the Iranian government, it also allows them to monopolize everything. It allows them to monopolize telecommunications so that they can shut off the internet with the flick of a switch. And so I think that actually sanctions have only ever harmed Iranian people and have actually emboldened the Iranian government and allowed the level of repression that it's able to enact in this moment as well too. And they really work together very well, unfortunately, while Iranian people find themselves between a rock and a hard place. I think another example of that right now is the fact that there are strikes that have broken out across the country. And this is one of the key efforts right now, that if the movement for total strike in Iran is successful, this could very directly lead to an actual full-blown revolution that could cause the end of this government. Yet, a lot of workers are very unsure and hesitant about going on strike. Why? If anyone has worked in labor movements, you know that striking workers need to be supported. They need to be able to understand that they will, or like have resources to be able to eat food and pay their bills while they're on strike, and able to, in order to have a sort of sustainable strike. And that can't happen when in an economy that has been spiraling downward, and there's also no access for any funds to come in to support striking workers. There are no funds domestically that are supporting the welfare state that mm-hmm. had existed before.
Sure.
And so we're also seeing sanctions actually also supporting
right.
the sort of crushing of workers' abilities to strike in this moment against the government. So I absolutely think that the United States, I think, needs to shut up and sit down a little bit, honestly.
Sure.
And I think have
cool.
only ever caused violence, and we need solidarity from people and not states.
On that note, we're going to have to leave it there. Hoda Katebi and Dr. Farhanak Maraftab, thank you so much for being with us. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show.